Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
I guess kind of change in perspective that comes with being a parent that makes you walk around with your pockets full of sticks and all of that stuff. They will say to other kids, they're like, look, some people have a daddy and a papa and some people have just a mommy. And they just have this kind of way of contextualizing that there are different families. The realness of our families is the thing that matters.
Hello and welcome to Some Families. We are a one-stop shop for all your queer parenting qualms and queries. My name, hello listener, is Stu Oakley, and I'm here with my gorgeous co-host, Lottie Jeffs.
Hello, hello Stu, welcome to Some Families. Can you believe this is our second to last episode of the season? Oh, I can't believe it. What will we do without this weekly get together?
No, it's so weird. And here we are again at the end of series two, pretty much doing remote recording at home. And also, can I just add, being very aggressively told that our meeting is being recorded by the new Zoom lady voice, which scares the life out of me every time it comes on. But yeah, but I really, you know, we've got one more episode to go, but what a fab series we've had so far.
Save your reflections for next week, babe.
But yeah, but how have you been? How have you been this week, Lottie?
I've been good. I have discovered a new TV show that I'm enjoying with my daughter called Bluey, who is just like, I mean, just blows Peppa Pig out of the water in terms of like how sexist and heteronormative Peppa Pig is.
Bluey, you know my feelings on
Peppa.
Oh,
don't get you started. No, Bluey is basically like, it's an Australian cartoon. It's just come onto BBC iPlayer. And I'm not the only one that loves it, by the way. There was a whole article on The Guardian about how great it was. But it's like a mum, dad and two girl dogs. But just the subtleties of the gender dynamics between the mum and the dad are just great. Like, it's just small things that, like, the dog dad comes in the morning doing, he's got a big pile of washing that he's folding. And the mum's the one that goes out to hockey with her sister while the two dads stay home and look after the kids and end up having to pretend to be, the kids make them be getting married. And so the dad and his brother, there's an episode where the dad and the brother have to pretend to be horses who are getting married to each other. And they're just such good sports. And they did, whereas something like Peppa Pig, it's just all so boring and like normative, isn't it? So, yeah. And I've found my parenting, what's the word? Not role model, my parenting like equivalent. I see myself reflected back at me in Bluey's dad. I'm like, oh my God, that's so me. He just comes in the morning, he's always like singing stupid songs and being like fun dad. And he's always, what he does that I really relate to is he always is getting like really into the imaginary games that his kids are doing and is having to like perform as the characters
so
that
cute.
They tell him that he must be.
And you're such a good mum. You're such a good, like, that is you. That's like, I love the imaginative play that you
that's
have.
That's definitely something that I feel like I can do. Like, I can get really into and storytelling and all that side of things. So anyway, Bluey, check it out if you haven't seen it. It's almost like picking up where Hey Dougie is left off for us.
Okay.
And there's just a sense of humour to it and a sort of kindness that I really like.
Nice. It's a shame that the same can't be said about Drag Race Down Under, which...
Oh, was it not good?
Oh, just, yeah, not great.
Really?
Yeah, it's just finished and...
Maybe it's just that the format's getting exhausted.
I don't think so. I think it was just, I think they were, you know, a bit ropey. But anyway.
Oh no, you don't have all these Australian drag queens coming after you now.
Anyway, off topic.
How's your week been when you've been being a parent? We should talk more in series three, if we do a series three, we should talk more about like ourselves and our lives outside of parenting, because we're always like, how's your week been? And it's like, well, I changed all these nappies and I did this, and it's like, actually no, listener, Stu and I are fully formed human beings who exist in the world outside of our children.
Who are we kidding?
I've just told the world that I'm like essentially a cartoon dad.
Exactly, you're just all about Bluey. But no, actually something really nice today. It sounds like two old men, it sounds like, but because I'm working from home at the moment and John's obviously working from home, my husband, and the kids were all out today at their various childminders, stroke nursery, stroke school. And he just messaged me and he was like, oh, on my lunch break, I need to pop to the local garden centre. He was like, do you want to come and we can get a coffee and walk around the garden centre? And so we did that, and we never do that. Like, we never do that. And it was just so nice. I mean, we were in the car and I was like, this is the first time we've been in the car together on our own in, I reckon, a year without the kids in the back. It was a really weird, like, home alone feeling.
You had a date day.
Yeah, it was a date down, like, our lunchtime at the garden centre looking at plants. I mean, I felt like I was about 80, but it was very cute. And, yeah, I had a really nice
time. It is
important
to have those times where you just connect as two people rather than,
I mean, all we talked about was the kids. It's always the same. It's all we talked about. But then... And actually, really nice this weekend. We went out with a couple of local gay dads, which, you know, listener, and Lottie. Yeah, like, we had a mutual friend that introduced us ages ago. And it's the first time we've properly met up with the kids. And it was lovely because, you know, you're always out socialising with, like, randoms on the street.
God. I'm desperate. I'll befriend anyone.
People you're meeting on mum's apps, like, you know, things like that. But I never do it. So it was really nice to do. And it was actually the first time that our children had met other parents who were two dads.
Ooh,
and
how did that go? Were they sort of interested in it? Did they like it?
Yeah, it was so nice. And my daughter said to me, I was tucking her in bed that night, and she said, no, we were reading, I think it might have been my daddy's, the Gareth and Gary book, and we were reading it. I said to her, oh, and it's like your friend that you met today has two daddies. And she went, yeah. She was like, we're matching pairs. I was like,
oh,
my gosh,
that's so sweet.
So cute, matching pairs. I mean,
how old are their kids? Are they the same age?
Just one, a boy who is six, so similar age to my daughter. But obviously my middle son was like looking up to him and like loved playing with him. It was really sweet, and look forward to building that relationship and with the kids especially. So,
yeah,
you know, they were on the swings talking about which daddy farts the loudest and which daddy has the smelliest farts, and it was hilarious. It was quite funny. She was like, my daddy has that too, and I have two dads. It was really sweet.
Oh my god,
really,
that's
sweet.
Adorable. So talking about sort of parenting and who we are as people and as
not
parents
farts.
And yeah.
not
that. Today's episode, we're talking to the author of a new book called Small on motherhoods, which is written by a woman called Claire Lynch. And the book is essentially her memoir, and it's an exploration of motherhood and motherhoods. The plural is quite important, as she'll explain, and how we, the ongoing process of becoming mothers or becoming parents. And the book is called Small because she uses this sense of the smallness of the process somehow of fertility, like the smallness of the egg, of the test tube, of the small decisions that you make that lead you up to this big decision. She kind of contrasts this idea with the enormity of what it is to bring a child into the world, however you do so. So we will be talking to Claire momentarily.
Claire and her wife have three daughters, two twins and a younger two-year-old, and they live in Windsor. Claire and her wife had their children via reciprocal IVF, something which now I know loads about.
Thanks to some of so our proud of yourself for that, aren't you?
I'm basically an expert listener, so I am. Her book is out now. It came out last week, and we're going to put a link to it in the show notes as well.
So without further ado, here is Claire. So welcome, Claire, to Some Families. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
I can't wait to delve into your new book that has literally just hit the shelves. But before we do, just want to ask a little bit about yourself and your family.
Sure. Well, as the children like to tell people, we are a girl family. So it's me and my wife, Bethan, and we have three daughters, five-year-old twins, and then the little one is two.
Amazing. And we'll get more into this as we talk about your book. But would you mind sharing with us how your children came into the world?
Absolutely. Yeah. So they were conceived by a reciprocal IVF, which I know has been discussed on the podcast before, and via an anonymous donor. So I guess the kind of interesting thing about that too is that they were actually all conceived at the same time through the same cycle. And so that, you know, but obviously with the gap between the older two and our little one. But it was a long process. That kind of that sentence, I suppose, kind of makes it sound as if it was a sort of straightforward tick box exercise, which is far from the case. But that process was quite important to us, I think, to kind of be involved, you know, in the pregnancy.
So did you carry, or was it your partner?
No, Beth carried. So they are biologically my children, I suppose, if you want to kind of use those terms. And she's the birth mother.
Wow. So many questions. Let's talk about the book quickly.
Yeah, it's called Small, and the subtitle is on motherhoods. And I think that kind of plural motherhoods is really important, actually, that it's obviously, you know, two mothers in our family, but also thinking about all the different kinds of parenting that can kind of come under that heading. It's called that, I guess, because it's about all of the small things that make up parenting. So, you know, we've already discussed the kind of beginning stage. And I think when you're going through trying to get pregnant in whatever method you're going about, that kind of focus on, you know, the cells and the real detail of how you're going to make that happen can become quite, you know, all consuming. And then, as you know, once the children are here, I mean, in this case, our children were premature also. So we had the kind of smallness of them when they're in neonatal. And then now they're, you know, older, all of the small things that matter so much to them, you know, so the kind of the way that they see the world, the way that they make us see the world, I guess, kind of change in perspective that comes with being a parent, that makes you walk around with your pockets full of sticks and all of that stuff.
I found a kazoo in my pocket this morning.
Yeah, standard. I can't believe you're showing off about that. Yeah. Who didn't find a kazoo in their pocket this morning? Yeah.
Although, fun fact, the kids got given a kazoo the other day and I had no idea how to blow it. I realised they never knew how to blow a kazoo, but they all did, and they thought it was like some kind of magic spell because they could make a sound out of kazoo. I was just like, no.
Yeah, I think the question is, who hates you so much that they gave your kids a kazoo? That's really
That's actually kind of an interesting segue into something we wanted to get onto talking about how, like, our past experiences and our childhoods shape us as parents. It's something you explore in the book. And obviously Stu never came across a kazoo. And
poor thing.
Yeah. And I was deprived. Child.
Can you talk a bit to that idea and how you explore that in the book?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I was interested in when I was writing it is actually the older two, like I said, are five and a half, they'd probably like me to say, for the record. And that means that they're kind of getting closer to an age that I really remember. So the kind of the way that they're playing, the things that matter to them are now things that I remember mattering, you know, to me also, right? So in fact, as I'm talking to you now, I'm kind of hoping that the noise of like an intense Sylvanian Families game is not going to break into the background of the podcast. But all of that, I think, kind of returns you to kind of remembering the things that I think when you're a small person, when you're a small child, you know, all of the kind of drama that happens in the playground, that it's very easy for parents to brush aside. But when you remember how it felt for you, when you remember that kind of feeling of the scale of things as relative to your position in the world, the same thing with the two-year-old, you know, the things that will knock a two-year-old to the ground in a tantrum. And, you know, it's very easy when you're an adult to just be like, the biscuit is still fine, right? It's still a biscuit, But if it's broken in two now and they just want to destroy everything around them because the biscuit is now not the thing, you know, that it was promised to be. And you've got to find some way to manage that as a parent, haven't you? And you can either be frustrated all the time or you can kind of remember, no, I get that actually.
Definitely like tapping into those feelings.
Mm. Yeah, or kind of seeing what it is to cope with that.
Well, it sounds like what you're describing, it's almost like as adoptive parents, what we go through the training of therapeutic parenting and really understanding what could be going through a child's head as they're having that tantrum or they're saying what they're saying. Not necessarily that I live by those rules day by day, but because it's very easy to fall out of that. But
yeah, when you're under pressure,
it's trying to take yourself back in that moment to go, actually, hang on. Like, they are a little person, as you say, and that's what's in their world is so different.
That's why I think the title of your book, Small, and that idea of smallness in relation to the enormity of parenting is really interesting and a really new way into talking about fertility and parenting and stuff. So we've talked there about, you know, these are ostensibly really small things that happen every day. Someone drops a biscuit, something happens in the playground, but once you really access, you know, those memories in yourself and you start thinking about how your child's feeling, how you're reacting to your child, suddenly it's huge. So I think it's so interesting in your book that you've got the duality of the bigness of it and the everyday smallness of it.
Yeah, I mean, you've described it really well, actually, because I mean, what I wanted to get to was that contradiction, exactly as you're saying, you know, that there are these moments of, you know, where it all feels kind of profound and you're like dealing with these brand new people and you're trying to show them the world. And then it's kind of mundane, like, is the PE kit washed? That happens within the same 5 minutes, you know, and you're dealing with that all the time. Kind of how can you explore what it is to love these people in this way that is kind of overwhelming, but also be kind of driven mad that they won't kind of rinse the shampoo out of their hair when you need them to, or all of that kind of back and forth that you're living through, the big and the small all the time. And I think we need to let ourselves talk about that, actually, because, you know, the practical stuff is there and we can help each other. But sometimes acknowledging the enormity of the emotion of parenthood, I think people can be a bit sort of, it's easier to make fun of it, right? It's easier to kind of say it's a jokey thing and not, you know, let ourselves say, you know, what's hard about it is that constant movement between the nothingness and the kind of huge emotion that comes with it.
And also moving between the past and the present in the sense of, like, everything we do as parents, you know, we're coming out from our own collage of experiences as children and as adults, and especially as queer people, it's not like we're suddenly like a parent and our own identity that's been shaped from years of everything else that's happened to us falls away. And it's like interesting sometimes negotiating, I think, that idea of ourselves as parents and who we are and what we've done in the past. There's a beautiful bit that you open the book with, which, if you'll forgive me for reading your own book back to you, which I know from having written a book myself, can be very embarrassing.
I'll close my eyes. Yeah.
Isn't this, in the end, how families work? Each of us caught up in tangles of ourselves, past and presence all at once. Memories of who we have been, small clues that hint at who we might become. I think that's a really beautiful way of summing up that idea that we just talked about.
That part of it too, I suppose, is that awareness of the pace of change in family life. And, you know, you're so aware, aren't you, of the kind of the children as they are now, but also how quickly they're moving into being these other people. That sometimes you get those kind of flashes of who they might be. So, I mean, it's sort of a running joke in our house, I suppose. But, you know, when you see these kind of three sisters battling over, you know, My Little Ponies or whatever it is now, and you think, I can see now already, like, what that turns into when you're teenagers, or what that turns into when you're fully grown women kind of supporting each other, I hope, but probably also rowing over something. And that kind of, you're still versions of who you've always been, but you're also going to be these other people that will also be changing alongside you, right? So that's a really powerful thing, I think, to kind of keep in mind, is that we're all doing that as a family, remaking ourselves or kind of changing in relation to one another.
Yeah, that sense of transitioning as a family, you're constantly transitioning. And actually, it's something we talked about in a recent episode with non-binary parent Peyton and her feelings on how we do transition as parents at this moment in time. How would you think and how would you want your daughters to kind of describe you and kind of position you as a person? Is that something you've thought about?
Oh, God. I would say that they are, at the moment, the older ones, fascinated with the idea of kind of who we were before we had them. They want to know, for example, places that I suppose it's because we've all been so locked down, but they're kind of fascinated with hearing like places that we went before we had them, or the people that we were.
That's so sweet.
Yeah, maybe it's just because of go-getters, it's hard to say, but you know, they like that kind of idea of they want to make sense of their own story, I think, by seeing their beginning as our beginning.
That's so interesting. That's not something, and I think Lottie the same with your reaction, that's not something that has actually, just thinking about it now, has ever come up. We look at the world map and we talk about the places we've been with them, or the places where different people live, but I've never sat down, and we talk, and then through adoption as well, there's obviously, we talk so much about their life story and where they've been and their
journey to us.
I know.
Because how fabulous you used to be before you had 3 kids.
This is what I'm thinking. I think I've missed a trick here. But just in terms of what, you know, you're saying, Claire, I mean, that must help them so much understand who you are as a fuller being. And actually, how refreshing it would have been to have known what my mum and dad got up to before me and grown up with that knowledge, rather than finding out about it in my late teens or early 20s when I started to become interested
Maybe
in
that's
that.
A really nice thing to share with them, actually.
I mean, I want to be clear. It's not like I've got a slideshow running of like, you know, and here's mummy and mama on the Eiffel Tower or whatever. Like, let's all admire that. I think it's just...
That's what I'm thinking. That's what I'm
I mean, that's what you should do. Yeah. A lecture series about your past. But I mean, I think it's just a kind of like a positioning thing, isn't it? And I think they love talking about their own story, I suppose, and I think it's just part of that. And I mean, I think it's very much the prologue of, they love the story of, you know, they like to say, oh, we were in mummy's tummy when we were tiny eggs, and then we were in mama's tummy, and that's the, you know, it's all part of that kind of story of who they are and where they fit into the world.
Yeah. When did you start talking to them about that?
I think it kind of came up mostly when Beth was pregnant with our youngest daughter. So I think then the older two, who would have been like 3 then, you know, it made sense to them that they could kind of understand this narrative in relation to their little sister, and that it's the same story. And I think, I don't know, I mean, I think it's just always been part of their sense of who they are.
Let's get into a bit about, if you don't mind, more of the detail of the process, because it's something that really resonated for me reading your book, Small, and having had a few tries of doing IVF myself, unsuccessfully, sadly, but just the way you talk about being in the room, and I'm sure a lot of women listening to this will have probably been to the same clinic, and it seems from reading it that it's the same clinic, and I was like, I have been in that room, I have had that anaesthetist say that exact same thing to me, and I've had that feeling of doing the egg collection and going under, and the detail of your experience of IVF, did it work first time for you, and how did you, because obviously, so you were doing the egg collection, how did you find the injections and the process and everything?
We tried all sorts of different ways and over a long, long period of time. I think less catchy subtitle for the book would have been all the naive things that Claire thought that turned out to be a load of old rubbish. Because I think we were really naive. I think we thought that we were healthy and of the right age, and all we had was this kind of missing ingredient to fix the problem of becoming parents. It's an aspect that we don't talk about all that much, actually, is that there's no reason at all why a queer woman wouldn't also have unexplained infertility or any version of infertility. And it does need addressing, I think, really, because, you know, the idea that it's a technical matter of just sort of turning up at the clinic and handing over the credit card, I think it can lead people to unnecessary levels of stress and the kind of grief of it, I think, if you start in that position. Whereas I suppose if there is an advantage, if it's not inappropriate to say this, you know, a straight couple who've been trying for a long time and know that they need IVF are kind of going into that from a position of, you know, being ready for help and expecting it to be difficult. You know, maybe that's an unreasonable thing to say, but I
think you're right. Yeah. Mm. Especially when you're sort of somebody that like is used to things going your way in life, or being able to assert some control over things.
Yeah.
It can be really hard. I mean, I really struggled with the fact that like, it's like the sperm is literally being put into the egg and then being put back in exactly the right place. And you're telling me it still hasn't worked. It's so frustrating because you just think, how the hell does anyone ever get pregnant? And it's hard for me because it worked first time for my wife with IUI. and then I've done IUI wasn't working for me, and IVF hasn't worked for me either. So it just feels like an absolute miracle that it worked at all for my wife. And now I just feel like when I've done it, it's like doing this weird like pretend test game where it's the fact that it's ever going to actually be potentially a child is just not in it. It's like trying to pass a test.
And I think the kind of sex education narrative that we all grow up on is that, you know, it's dangerously easy to get pregnant and you better watch out that you don't get pregnant. To sort of find out that the truth might not be, you know, as straightforward, I think is a shocking thing to have to deal with. I mean, you asked me about the injections and things like that. I think actually when I think back on it now, I don't know what the word is. I think kind of shocked at how willing I was just to do everything and anything. Mm-hmm. So when they said, you know, there's this extra procedure, it's going to be uncomfortable and expensive, I would say, well, you know, here's the money. Or there's, you know, these injections are more painful, fine, I'll do whatever, you know. And so I think when you're in that world, and almost the more you're doing it and the more unsuccessful it is, the more you're trapped then.
Yeah, there's a great quote in your book where you say, each failed attempt was a lesson in reality, another dent in our hope. I spent hours then lurking on online forums, scouring the potted biographies of strangers for tips and clues. Eat pineapple core, try acupuncture, buy flaxseed. Women still trying after 10, 11, 12 cycles of unsuccessful treatment, a commitment, an addiction. I think that really will probably resonate for a lot of our listeners. Because when do you stop? Like, that's a question I've been asking myself. I mean, obviously when the money runs out, but let's say money is no object.
The addiction quote within that as well, I find really interesting. Just as a bystander to, obviously the process is not something I've ever been through, but it's something I'm learning and educating myself on through Lottie and guests like yourself. But I've never really thought of it in that sense of it being like an addiction, because you are going,
it does become like an obsession, doesn't it?
You know, in a practical sense, it's taking over everything that you're doing and thinking all the time. You're thinking, well, we can't travel to that wedding, or we can't go to this work thing because, you know, we'll be needed for this appointment. And I think people are willing to make physical and emotional and financial sacrifices that are not always wise, much as people in addiction do the same, because there's always that kind of sense of, well, maybe this time will be the time.
Yeah, it's like waiting for a bus. You're like, if I just...
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
As soon as you walk away from the bus stop.
Exactly.
And then twins come along.
Exactly.
Yeah, well...
Okay, I have two new obsessions that I need to share with you. Impress No Glue Press-On Manis and Impress Press-On Falsies Lashes. Trust me, these are getting ready game changers. Both require no glue, so there is no damage to your natural nails and lashes, no mess, and no annoying dry times. Just one step and you're done. Boom. Instant glam. Visit impressbeauty.com/presson and use code PRESSON25 at checkout for 25% off Impress manicure and Press-On falsies.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Can I ask you both a question? I'm just really interested. We're talking about the emotion of how you feel and thinking back about, you know, that feeling of going into the clinic and feeling and not expecting anything to be going wrong. Like you said, you're going in thinking, right, this is what we're going to do and X, Y, and Z, and we're going to get pregnant. What was that feeling like the moment you found out things weren't going in the way that you thought? Do you remember how you feel? And would you equate that to a part of grief potentially as well for mourning something that you felt was an easy win?
Yeah, it's almost like mourning something that you never had. Mourning the idea of something, mourning a dream. It's a strange kind of grief, I think. Would you agree, Claire?
I would. And I think there's also these kind of waves of that that maybe... In my case, I'm sure that there was kind of a stage, maybe when I was a teenager or much younger person coming out, thinking, would this be part, you know, it's a thing I want, but will it be part of my future? And then reaching a stage where you think, well, sure, now it's fine and I can go to this clinic. And then hang on a minute, the fairy tale is not working out as I had planned or anticipated. And one of the things I think that's really interesting is that we're probably among... I don't know if it's the first generation, maybe, of queer people where kind of in-laws might be kind of saying, well, where are the children? Probably like quite heteronormative expectations that you might have children are also on you. And so I think that was also a kind of strange thing, that we were always kind of playing this game of some people not expecting that at all. So you could just be doing this quietly in the background and not share that grief, when actually that probably would have helped to have that support. But also somehow that element of it being quite difficult to explain, because just as we've said, if we were naive walking into it, then other people also have that assumption that it's an easy thing to do.
Another thing that resonated for me with your book and the idea of smallness is staring at that tiny window on a pregnancy test and just willing it, like these tiny little lines, like one line or two lines, and just like staring at this tiny window, and then the result of these lines being like such an enormous thing. Like, either your life's going to change and you're going to have a child, or it's just not. And that's just something that really resonated for me, and just the remembering myself and the times I've stared at that window and just been like, just another line, just two lines, come on, two lines. And then it's just one line. You're like, fuck's sake.
Yeah.
And to answer your question, Stu, about how that feels, like, I think in that moment of like seeing one line and wishing that it was two, for me, it feels like not passing a test. It feels like getting, I've always been like a really annoying high achiever, so it feels like getting a C.
But isn't it much worse than a C, right? Because it's like you've been revising for an A, right? And
yeah.
You've been not drinking the wine, and you've
exactly.
been going to the stupid yoga or whatever the thing is you've been doing, and
yes.
then you get an F anyway.
It's an
F. You know? And that's one of the things I wanted to write about, is that there's no, that, you know, effort does not equal success in this.
Yes.
And that's a really
so
difficult
true.
Concept to kind of get your head around, you know,
yeah.
especially when you are, if you're in a couple and you're doing this and you're really working hard on thinking about, oh, we'd be such good parents and these are the parents we would be and we want this so much, and you're kind of always in a world where everyone seems to be accidentally getting pregnant. So that kind of clash between all the effort that you're putting in and the the lack of success all the same, maybe that's why I couldn't answer that question very much about what the children, how the children would describe me or what they would say about that, is because I think that probably filters into the kind of parent you become, you know, that kind of consciousness of that process. And I'm sure the same is true if you're an adoptive parent, that you're conscious all the time of, look at all we did to show you how much we loved you. And now how do I keep on negotiating that for the rest of your life?
Yeah, you know? God, you don't want to be the parent that's like,
that's really
you've got no idea what I did
exactly.
to bring
yeah.
you into the world.
Exactly.
And the kid's like, I didn't ask to be born.
Exactly.
And you're like, it cost me £50,000 at the London Women's Clinic to have you.
Exactly. You can't be that person, and nor can you be
really,
you know, the
awful.
Sort of, we loved you so much before you were born or before you came to join our family. This is, you know,
totally.
You just can't.
Yeah.
When people talk about, like, talking to the kids about how special they are, it sometimes worries me. Like, I feel like it's not something I want to tell my kid, is like, I don't want there to be a sense of like preciousness about her. And maybe you feel the same with adoption, Stu, of like, you don't want to go too far down, like, you're really special and different.
Yeah, it's a fine line. And the word lucky as well is something when it comes to adoptive families that I think is a kind of wince word for a lot of people as well. Like,
I can imagine, yeah,
they're so lucky to have you as parents, or you're so lucky to have them. And it's like, there's so much depth to that.
That's really
laden.
Interesting that you say that, actually, Stu, because one of the wince word for me is the kind of people who say they're just miracles. They're miracle children. And you're like, well, no.
That's a lot to have on your shoulders as a child,
yeah.
Like, isn't it?
Let's all just calm down. I mean,
yeah.
You know, this is the science is a miraculous thing. And, you know, we can be grateful to have access to that. and whatever. But it's it also just kind of differentiates, right? It's unnecessary.
And it's a weight of expectation for them to carry in the future, right? Like to think that they're miracle children. It's like, oh God, am I just going to be disappointing you at every single turn because I'm not the miracle child you wanted me to be?
Yeah, like, exactly.
It's so laden.
How do you talk to your girls, Claire, about the fact that they've got two mums? And do you have any advice for people like myself who have younger children that the questions are just sort of occurring now?
Yeah, I mean, it was a thing that we thought about, and that, you know, you do kind of not worry about in advance, but kind of consider in advance. And in our case, as soon as they could talk, they just called us mummy and mama, and they are really not just annoyed but perplexed if anyone can't get their heads around that. You know,
I can imagine my daughter being exactly the same.
If someone will say, oh, you know, your mummies are doing this, they're like, well, no, we don't have two mummies, right? This is our mummy and this is our mama. Like, they are different people. Why is that not clear to you, I think? And we're lucky, I think, that they just have operated in quite a confident way about that all along, and they just have a sense. And they will say to other kids, they're like, look, some people have a daddy and a papa, and some people have just a mummy. And they just have this kind of way of contextualizing that there are different families, right? And they just are so used to that, that I think the only time that it is... I mean, it's more, at the moment, I think it's more kind of funny to see them engage with other kids about that and just sort of be very straightforward and explain it. But I'm sure one of the things I kind of write about in the book is, you know, I'm sure kind of this will not be that easy forever, but maybe not. I mean, maybe they are just operating in a world where that, I mean, of course, that's the only, that's their family, we're their parents.
To follow on from something else you said in the book with that as well, about, I think you talk about the donor and saying a prayer of thanks to him as you blow out the candles, etc. How have you, or have you not yet perhaps discussed the donor's role within their creation, and what are your plans for that as well in the future?
So far it hasn't been as much part of the discussions, just because I think technically I'm not sure that they would get their heads around that idea just yet. I think what they're very clear on is that they were made, if you like, with lots of help, right? So I think they're very aware that, you know, that doctors had to collect eggs from me, and that they had to be fertilized, you know, a scientist had to help, and they had to be put back into mama's tummy. They're very aware of that as part of the story. And I think that will be the next thing that we talk about as they get a little bit older. And in a practical sense, you know, I'm also aware that when they are 18, if they want to, they will be able to find out more about the donor. And one of the things that informed our choice was, you know, trying to choose someone who you thought would be hopefully a good person to find.
Yeah.
I would be surprised if, knowing their personalities already, and hopefully knowing the way that we're open with one another, I'm sure they will want to do that as soon as they can. But I also have to feel confident that they will want us to do that with them, and to help them, and to be kind of part of that conversation. I think that's what you have to kind of go into it with, that open-mindedness already there, I think. You know, my only hope is that they will wait till their younger sister is also old enough, so they can do it all together, you know, that can be part of it.
I was thinking, as you were talking, Claire, like, there's going to be a time in probably like the next 10 years when all of the people our age, or in our sort of generation, that have queer families, that have used donors, it's going to be a thing that happens to all of us and our friends. It'll be like, has your kid met their donor yet?
It's really hard to know, isn't it? I think you've got to try and put yourself in that position and try and imagine, you know, what would you have done in that situation when you were 18? Probably, I mean, I'm sure everyone would be kind of curious to find out. Maybe they won't.
Maybe they won't
be bothered. Yeah. I mean, I don't know, really.
I think it's the same with adoption and the quest to find out more about your birth family and your...
What's the deal with that, with adoption? Can they get in touch with their birth family whenever they want to?
Well, it's very similar. I mean, it's each to each case, but generally I think it's similar as you talked about the donor finding out as well. Like, when they're 18, they can have access to their files and have names and details and be able to find whoever they want to find, should they wish to. There's been some really, and it was interesting what you said, Claire, because it's always been something that comes up in the adoption world about supporting them through that and being open and honest about it from as early as you can, so that you can go on that journey with them, so that you can basically hold their hand as they go through that journey. But there's been a lot, especially with social media, there was news stories a couple of weeks ago about an adoptive family who, because of social media, their adopted child found out early their birth family's name, started to get in contact behind the adoptive parents' back through social media. They'd been with them for about 10, 12 years, I think, then just broke down, and they now don't speak to them. They've kind of been semi unofficially taken back in by the birth family, who,
oh no,
they've gone on a downward spiral. So it's the importance of, I suppose, being aware of social media. It's not something we've ever really talked about, in the sense of, I don't know how that works from a donor point of view.
Yeah, it's very like, there's no way you'd know the name, the real name of the donor.
I think all you can really kind of do in these conversations is to say that what you're, the realness of our families is the thing that matters. When you kind of bring up the point about their birthdays, the point is really, it's almost only on their birthday that the thought kind of comes back to me. I want to kind of mark that in my own mind, and I want to kind of respect and thank that person, because our family wouldn't exist without him. Mm. But he's not in our family, and he's not a person who will shape them. And it will be a thing of interest to them, I'm sure, and it will be a thing that will be kind of part of our experience as a family, you know, later down the line. But I think that kind of sense of the job of being a parent is so much more than biology, right?
Yes. And that's going to be a quote on our Instagram.
Yeah. And that's why I guess I kind of was a bit sort of stuttering when you asked me about how we made our family, or how they were conceived, because I think however you describe that story, it kind of creates a hierarchy that isn't relevant. That's why reciprocal IVF is kind of interesting, because the playing field is kind of leveled in some way. But it's also always kind of under question. So in the book, one of the things I'm talking about, I guess, is how easy it was for people to kind of sideline or ignore me in those hospital situations. Mm. Because Bethan was the pregnant woman, and rightly was the person who should have had all the focus on her. But I think for anyone to kind of manage to hold in their minds that also, you know, when they were born, for instance, having to always say, don't look at her blood group, look at mine. Right. Or, you know, when they're having their hearing tested when they were newborns, it's my family history that is the thing that you need to ask questions about, not hers.
That
must
have just blown some health visitors' minds, because it's hard enough for some of them to get their head around two mums, let alone.
Yeah, exactly. That. I guess the whole point, right, that motherhood can be all of these different things at once.
Mm. You have a bit in the book that we hoped you might read for us about your NCT class.
Sure. Well, I wanted to read this bit because I think it is, I guess, kind of, you know, indicative of this situation where, you know, you can be kind of like misread as problematic when, you know, there you are trying to do your best to sort of find out about what it's going to be like to be a parent. So we went to antenatal classes, like I guess a lot of parents do. And this was the experience. We arrive early for the first session, nervous, excited to meet the other new parents in waiting. Our teacher is setting up her flip chart and greets us not with a welcome, but an apology. I'm just going to say sorry from the start, she blurts. I'm bound to say the wrong thing, you know, with the language about all of this. She gestures vaguely between our midriffs, indicating, it seems, that she is aware that we have the same genitals, and turns back to her flip chart. It's only several hours later that it occurs to me that this might have been our cue to ask for a refund and leave without further insult or expense. Instead, we take a seat. Our guide to all things childbirth, Paula, wears the same wide-fit sandals and blouse each week as if it were a uniform. She has two grown-up children of her own, and it's clear she will never be as happy again as she was when they were babies. It is equally clear that she doesn't know what to do with me. In fact, she suggests, it might be better if I sit the first activity out. It can get really physical, she warns. She wouldn't want me to get hurt. At this unexpected announcement, the men in the group start to give each other sideways glances. At worst, they thought they might have to watch a birth video. Nobody said anything about bare-knuckle fighting. Lacking an alternative, I stride towards the circle, adopting a gait which suggests surprising physical strength, or at least hints, I hope, at a woman who might have been inter-county judo champion in her youth. Right, I will stop there.
But I mean, no, I want you to keep going.
I mean, the whole point was that she, you know, this kind of very weird idea that she had about kind of who mums and dads are and what they're expected to do was just, oh, I think, kind of crazy, under a spotlight. You know, it wasn't a version of parenthood that matched any of the people in that room.
It makes everyone feel awkward, doesn't it? Like, yeah. We need to campaign for just better education and NCT and health, NHS. Like, it just needs to be better for queer and non-binary people.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I'm one of the things I wonder about this is we live in a, you know, a small town, and, you know, maybe it was the first time that this antenatal class teacher had had to deal with this situation.
But I suppose the question is then, do you think she actually would have changed if she had had two mothers in her next antenatal class?
Or she'll probably be like, oh, I've had a couple like you in before. It's like something.
Yeah,
like
yeah. I mean, I think that's what she did say. I mean, what happens next is that we have to join arms and pretend to be a cervix. So, yeah, it only gets better from that point on. What happened, I guess, in that situation is that I had to be quite difficult. Like, I had to challenge, and I had to say... So there was a lot of mums and dads being separated. And so I had to say, like, where do you want me to go? And so the problem with that is that you then kind of reinforce this idea that these are going to be parents who are going to make things difficult, right?
Yeah.
And you're like,
and all you're trying to do is, like,
yeah,
your best and the right.
Well, all I'm trying to do is find out about, you know, winding and contractions,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
I'm not here to challenge you, but since I am here and since you've refused to kind of be thoughtful about these things, I am going to be the pain in the
good
ass who says, you know, what if we did this a bit differently? So hopefully those things are kind of always changing for the good.
Yeah.
Can I ask about support, and especially when you were going through the difficulties conceiving? There's obviously a large community of women who do go through difficulties when it comes to IVF and IUI, etc. But from a heteronormative point of view, did you find that you were able to relate and have support with those groups? Or do you think because you were coming to it from a different queer perspective, there was not much support that you could relate to?
It's interesting. I think it's one of the things that has changed really rapidly. So I think when we were going through it, which, you know, isn't that long ago, it was a lot of these really creepy kind of online forums where the point is, you know, even if you're reading them, the story never ends, right? Because if someone gets pregnant, they don't carry on telling you that story. They just get on with doing that. If somebody doesn't, they continue having their kind of difficult stories, if you see what I mean. So it's a sort of, the support is there, but really people are just kind of reinforcing that cycle of disappointment for themselves. Now, I can see now on, when I now look at Instagram, there are people who are so open about being in this journey and kind of supporting one another. And, you know, it seems to me that that's completely changed. I think that now people would easily be able to kind of access a community of other queer people who are in that process.
And you speak a bit about it in the book as well, the fact that your twins were premature, and which must have been really, really harrowing and just such a difficult time for you. And is there anything that you might like to say to anyone listening who is perhaps in a similar situation in terms of just surviving that?
Yeah, so I mean, they were born at 32 weeks, so they were kind of between together, they were the kind of the weight of a full-term baby, I guess. So kind of they were just 4 or 5 pounds each, and they were in hospital for quite a while. And I think the thing I would say is the thing that got us through it was the staff on the ward were such incredible, strong and straightforward people that you could look to them and know that it would be okay, you know. And I think that was essential to our survival of it. And one of the people I write about, who was a night nurse, who just spoke to us as parents. And so in those kind of long nights where, you know, the babies are all kind of wired up and oxygen tubes and all of these things, and she would just say to us things like, so do you think they'd like to be in the same class when they go to school, or do you think they'll be in different classes?
Oh, that's so nice.
And it was just such a powerful thing for her to do, just to say, this stage will be over, and they will, you know, they will go on to be little girls, and you'll have to make those kind of decisions, not should we give them more IV antibiotics today? You know, it'll be who's going to have what lunchbox, right? Mm-hmm. And it was such an important thing. And I think if you're in that situation and all you're thinking about is what's the next medical decision, somehow having faith that the next stage will come, I think is really, really important.
Beautiful. Yeah. Thank you.
I think we could do like a 6-hour special with you, I feel. But just to wrap up, if you were to briefly sum up what motherhood and parenthood means to you, and what it means within your family, how would you sum that up? Or how that's changed throughout writing the book as well? How do you feel your journey as a mother has changed and it enabled you to reflect back on your journey so far?
So I'm really kind of suspicious of these kind of cheesy ideas that kind of parenthood changes you as a person and that, you know, it's the only way that you kind of learn who you really are. But I'm also annoyed by the fact that I feel that about myself, you know. So yeah. I think it's as much about, you know, we were talking earlier about, you know, toddler tantrums and those kinds of things. And you really have to kind of learn, are you the kind of person who is just going to, you know, fight a tantrum with a tantrum? Or over time, are you someone who's going to learn from these experiences and kind of be the person that your children need you to be? And who they need you to be is always changing, right? So who they need you to be when they're a tiny baby in an incubator is not the person they need you to be at the school gate 5 years down the line. So I think that sense of responsiveness, maybe, or something like less corporate than that, but kind of, you know, like being self-aware, I think, is a really important kind of aspect of parenting, isn't it? Because it's, you know, the point is it stops being about you, but you have to still be there at the end. That's kind of the moral of the story, I guess, you know?
Yeah, I think that's a really nice way of describing
it. That's really nice. Thank you, Claire, and thank you so much, listener, for listening to this episode. We hope you enjoyed it as much as we did. I found Claire and her story and her viewpoint on everything fascinating and deeply interesting.
So many of our guests, I just wish we could just go out for a drink with. I feel like we'd have a really fun night out with Claire. We'd have nice drinks and dinner and just chew the fat, talk about parenting.
Well, what's stopping us? Let's do it.
This is true. We can. So, listener, we love to hear from you as well. If you want to take Stu and I out for a dinner or a drink, that
we are available.
We're available. Please do get in touch. You can slip into our DMs on Instagram or Twitter at somefamiliespod, or you can email us somefamilies@storyhunter.co.uk.
Or do check out our website, where everything is neatly and wonderfully housed at somefamiliespod.com. There are also full transcripts and past episodes there as well.
We'll be back next week with our last episode of the season.
So till then,
goodbye.
See you later.
This episode was produced and edited by Hattie Moyer.
Some Families is a Story Hunter production.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.